a carer, exploring the hidden stories behind the role. An introduction to the series. Welcome to Are You a Carer? Exploring the hidden stories behind the role. Keep listening to this episode if you'd like to hear an introduction to this mini-series uncovering the layered realities of caregiving. We will be thinking about ambiguity, legitimacy, and responsibility throughout the series. If you want to skip this intro, then episode one is all about how these concepts are at the very heart of how people feel about the label of carer. If you are still listening, then settle in for an introduction to the experiences, research, and ideas that led to the creation of this mini-series, as a story about how people become carers, what this means to them, and why we should all be paying more attention to the issues they face. For many people, the word carer carries mixed feelings. It can validate the work they do, but it can also feel reductive, even alien. Caregiving is full of contradictions, supporting someone else while feeling unseen yourself. What is it like to be feeling uncertain in a role where others both question your intentions and actions and rely on you to fill the gaps, pick up the slack, be there with someone who needs support when everyone else is gone? Over the next 5 episodes, we'll share stories from the lives of people who care for someone with a serious illness, interwoven with research that highlights what carers face, what they give, and what they need. A person needing healthcare is rarely completely isolated, and those important to them need to be considered if care is to be effective. As one healthcare worker put it,
"Trying to fold the caring network around a patient without reference to their family leaves a massive hole in the... It's like trying to fill a bath up with no plug."
Yet we found some people, families and friends, were subject to unevidenced judgment, biased assumptions about their motivations, questioning of their intentions and the expertise they brought by living in the situation with the person they were supporting. People described how when caring for someone at home, they were responsible for everything, relied upon by professionals. Yet if that person was admitted to hospital, all too often they felt excluded and treated as part of the problem. For some carers, doing what they did is just what you do, because you were there, because this is what being family or friend means, or because circumstances mean that there is no one else. As you will hear, becoming a carer can seem to happen by accident, being in the right or wrong, depending on your point of view, place at the time of need. For others, they recognised a crisis was coming. There was more need than it was possible for anyone to meet. But they felt they were being forced to try, and eventually fail before anyone else would notice. We heard a lot about guilt from people who described their best and often considerable efforts as never enough. The story of being a carer is, or will be at some point, about all of us. Not just because sooner or later we will all need to use healthcare, but because most of us are likely to find ourselves caring for others using healthcare systems at some point in life. The charity Carers UK estimates that more than 12,000 people become unpaid carers every day, and these people are contributing almost the same to the economy as the NHS budget for a year. The burden of caring is not evenly distributed. Carers are more likely to be female, and the financial impact of caring is greater for carers from minority groups. In the UK, we live in a society where attitudes and behaviours towards caring roles are inconsistent, conflicting, and contradictory. From a personal perspective, I was the person closest to hand when my maternal grandmother was dying, as we were living in the same city. By this point, she was already in a nursing home, and I'd used my professional knowledge to help my mum and my uncle navigate care and encourage the home and her GP to make decisions we believed were right for my grandma when she could no longer speak for herself due to a rapid onset dementia. When I think of her now, I think of how when I was a child, my grandma always had time for me and my siblings. Her love for us communicated through that time, patients, treats, and ironing everything, even to our great amusement, pants and socks. One of her lasting legacies is I'm still better at playing drafts than anyone else I've played. The evening she died, I'd been to see her. She'd been unwell with a chest infection, most probably because towards the end of her life, when she no longer recognised us, the only two things that seemed to bring pleasure were a tin of chocolates or strawberries to eat. And so we'd let her have these, even though we knew her swallow wasn't as good as it used to be and things might go down the wrong way. That evening she seemed better though, peaceful if tired. She held my hand and smiled, then went to sleep. I still feel a sense of professional failure at not knowing when I left she would die that night. When the call came, I went back to the home as the staff had called both the GP and the police to report her death. Not that it was unexpected, but to cover themselves for not sending her to hospital. Thankfully, this happens less often now with improved systems in place for when a death is clearly the end of an irreversible illness. I thought I was prepared. After all, I'd warned plenty of patients' relatives about this happening sometimes in my role as a doctor. Then the police officer asked if he could go through some questions with me, the routine. Even so, it was hard to know whether to laugh or cry when, after confirming who we were, he asked if my grandmother had held a firearms license. Perhaps he was new to the job. Perhaps he had the wrong after-death question list. But either way, it seemed unlikely this would be a fruitful line of questioning, and he did seem somewhat abashed when I said, "Really? Well, no, but why are you asking?" As I've been doing more research working with people with serious illness, both mental and physical, and those who support them, I've increasingly wondered just how much of our approach is based in assumptions and a system that doesn't really know how to handle the carer role or have a consistent approach to its legitimacy. Neither patient nor professional depended on to fill the gaps, but often with a sense of suspicion lurking. Pause for a minute to think how you introduce yourself in different ways to different people and in different places. The relationship between the things we do, the roles we take on, and how we see ourselves, our identity, if you like, is not straightforward. Thinking about the experiences shared reveals how our ideas about carers shape healthcare systems, our community and society's responses to people, how they're positioned and valued when supporting people with serious illnesses. We'll be exploring what it means to be a carer in a healthcare system that doesn't seem to have a consistent position on what this label, role, or responsibility means, or how good care should function when someone has a neighbour, friend, or family member caring for them. We will also talk about carers getting caught up in healthcare systems, learning to make them work for the person they support, and reflect on what it is like when a caring role comes to an end. As a medical doctor as well as a researcher, in both parts of my professional life, I'm one step removed from the primary carer role, but I've witnessed the interface between healthcare services and the so-called informal care provided by people who know the person in need hundreds, if not thousands, of times. And I've lost count of the times that I've shared my insider knowledge of healthcare systems to help a carer navigate the system, from magic words to trigger specific sorts of help, to capturing what is important to the person being cared for. The research study that this mini-series is based on sought to understand the role of relationship in healthcare, focusing specifically on how relationship can be redeemed, how we can interpret and apply the principles of relationship-centred practice in efforts to improve healthcare for people living with severe illness, whether mental or physical, more effective, not just technically safe, but also good care, in keeping with their needs, values and priorities. As a doctor, I am privy to all sorts of details of people's lives, and because I work clinically in palliative care, providing care to people with advanced illness, they're dying. As a researcher, I study the gaps between system design, what happens on paper, how care would ideally work within our health and social care system, and people's actual experiences of it. In my research, I work with people living with severe illness, whether that is physical illness needing palliative care support, or serious and enduring mental illness where people need help from mental health care services and those supporting them. People taking part in my research encouraged me to use this opportunity to be a voice for those who can't always tell the wider world themselves. Unpredictable multitasking for some carers' day-to-day lives can leave them mentally and physically exhausted, with no time for much else, while still feeling their efforts are unrecognised and unvalidated. I hope they will be content with my curation of their stories. You are going to hear some of the voices of people who've taken part in my research, including some who volunteered to discuss what it means to be a carer with me in more detail, especially for these episodes. But at the request of others, we have edited out or changed names and voices, with some quotations read by my colleagues, to protect the identities of them and those they support. If you'd like to hear more, please go to the next episode, Can I Call You a Carer?